Welcome to Few and Far Between, conversations about rare disease research. I'm your host from Bioassi, Wayne Bowden. On today's podcast, Jimmy El-Hokayem, head of the Neurology and Regenerative Medicine Centers of Excellence and Associate Director of Program Development at Bioassi, will be talking with Paula Evans. Paula is the CEO and co-founder of Genetics Biotherapeutics, and she's also a chairperson at the Foundation for Angelman Syndrome Therapeutics. Thank you for joining us, Jimmy.
Thank you, Wayne. Good to be here.
Why don't you talk a little bit about your discussion with Paula?
Sure. I've known Paula since 2010, and we also have a common mentor and a dear friend, Dr. Ed Weber. Paula's story is really a Cinderella story of sorts. Her commitment to her family and the Angelman syndrome community proves that anything is possible when it comes to rare disease research and treatment. Her story is also a testament to the incredible times we are living today, where medical research has advanced so much that the impossible treatments of yesterday are totally at reach today. I'm also very genuinely honored to know Paula and to be involved as a scientific advisory board member in the current work that is being done at the foundation she established.
Wow, that sounds really fascinating. Thanks, Jimmy. Why don't we get into your discussion with Paula right now?
Thank you, Paula, for joining us today. First, let me ask you to tell us a little bit about what you affectionately call the Cinderella story, the quick story behind the Foundation for Angelman Syndrome Therapeutics, or FAST, and you being the CEO of the foundation, and to, you know, becoming CEO of a biotech startup spinning off out of FAST.
Well, thank you very much, Jimmy, and I appreciate so much you inviting me here today. My name is Paula Evans. I am the founder and former chairperson of the Foundation for Angelman Syndrome Therapeutics. FAST is a nonprofit charitable organization that I started in 2008, about 4 years after my daughter was diagnosed with Angelman syndrome. I started the foundation at that time because I felt there wasn't enough focus on translational research and research that would eventually lead to the identification and development of a therapeutic for Angelman syndrome. So it was early days back then, about 13 years ago now, a completely different mindset than where we find ourselves today. And then, to kind of make a long story short, in 2017, the foundation started its own biotech to develop a potential therapeutic that was identified through a research program that the foundation had provided funding for.
That is amazing. And let me say in this respect that this is a really unique story because we don't see that in the regular foundation landscape. This specific and unique mindset allows these therapeutics to reach those patients in a record time that is unparalleled and not seen in the foundation's world or in the rare disease landscape or arena. Can you tell us a little bit, Paula, about, you know, your experience with Angelman syndrome beyond this scientific dry description of Angelman syndrome? Can you describe to us your experience with Angelman syndrome and how it affected your life and how it affected your child's life and the people around you?
Yes, absolutely. So that was a great description. On a genetic level, it's a very interesting, if not fascinating, disorder because it is a single gene disorder, a monogenetic disorder. But what makes it so unique, even amongst single gene disorders, is that it involves the phenomenon of imprinting. So whereas most of the genes in our genome, we have two copies of each gene, most, you know, for most of the genes, both copies are performing a function. There's a handful that are imprinted, meaning only one parent's copy is functional. And one of those genes is our UBE3A gene, where in myself, in you, Jimmy, everyone listening, the copy that we get from our mother is active in our brain, but the copy that we get from our father is silenced. And that's in, you know, all of us. So if you're born and your mother's copy is either missing or it's mutated or it's non-functional, then you have Angelman syndrome because you don't have the paternal copy, the father copy to compensate. So Angelman in and of itself is a very fascinating disorder. My daughter was born in 2004, And we received her diagnosis at 10 months of age, which was very young at that time. That was considered a very early diagnosis. And it was really just due to a wonderful pediatric resident who listened very carefully to my concerns and tested my daughter very young, 9 months of age. And we received her diagnosis at 10 months old. So whereas most parents are devastated when they get this diagnosis, because it does affect the child, you know, holistically, there are developmental delays, motor delays, almost complete loss of functional speech, seizures. I just didn't really understand the enormity of that at that time. But I mean, I think we can all imagine what our lives would be like if you could not speak at all and express just even your simple wishes and desires. My daughter had a bit of a complicated, her early years, toddler years were complicated. She was one of those children. This isn't common for Angelman. It's not uncommon, but it's not common. She actually spent quite a bit of time in the hospital. She was sick very often. Simple colds led to complete respiratory emergencies. So she had a complicated few years of life. And I would sit at the hospital and just read research articles on Angelman syndrome so that I could understand what it was. I had no background in genetics or biology or any of that. So I was just really just trying to understand. And I think I was either naive or ignorant enough to think to myself, well, gee, it's just one gene that's not working in her brain. Surely we can correct that. So at age 4, she turned a corner where she became more and more healthy. We were spending less and less time in the hospital. And at that point, I had surrounded myself with about a dozen like-minded parents trying to understand the research that had been done on Angelman and trying to understand if there was a way that we could treat this. And that research eventually led me to, as you know, Jimmy, Dr. Edwin Weber. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Mm-hmm. Weber was such a phenomenal mentor. And I would say about a year after meeting Dr. Weber, I realized that what was truly lacking in the world of Angelman syndrome was dedicated researchers and research funding. That's when I decided to start the Foundation for Angelman Syndrome Therapeutics so we could focus solely on funding the research that would, you know, identify a potential therapeutic. So my daughter was my inspiration. Ed Weber was my mentor. And I had some phenomenal like-minded parents that were willing to roll up their sleeves and help kind of change the world of Angelman syndrome.
That is amazing. It's such a heroic effort to first start the foundation, of course, and continue to where the foundation is today, which is a wonderful place that is really, we've not seen the like in any of the foundations actually that are active today in respect to being only in the discovery and enhancing discovery and the diagnosis and enhancing the research around the novel therapeutics regarding Angelman syndrome, but also taking it to the clinic. This is something I very press on because we don't see that in other foundations where the focus is mainly on funding. And then, you know, we let the PIs or the institutions figure out the way to commercialization and to taking the therapeutic or the drug to the clinic, to the patients, and basically fulfilling the cycle from the patient to the patient and from the community surrounding the patient to the patient again. That's something that we don't see often, and this is why I like to focus on that. Everyone else for the past, you know, 50 years, everyone was working on one function of the UBE3A protein, which is the ubiquitin ligase protein, meaning, you know, degradation of other proteins. So if the gene is lacking or defect, hence the protein is lacking, hence there's less degradation of proteins. Hence, everybody was looking for what are the proteins that would be accumulated that would lead to such manifestation. But after 50 years looking at the same thing, when I started working on this topic, I found out that the transcriptional coactivation function of the UBE3A protein, which is the second function, was nearly left uninvestigated. Nobody had looked into it, and nobody had looked at the possibility of it actually being involved in the pathobiology of Angelman syndrome, while you were able to actually push this forward and stand behind approaches that otherwise would not have been supported or funded by the regular funding, which leads us today to where we are in a place where dogma and science is being challenged, and not only challenged by speech and by words, but also by facts, by actually having clinical trials ongoing. And maybe you could give us an overview of, you know, what's new in the treatment of Angelman syndrome, and how did this roadmap to not only supporting the treatment, but actually having the treatment go through clinical trials happen to be?
So yes, you're right. When I started the foundation, there was a certain dogma surrounding Angelman syndrome, and that dogma was that, you know, it is what it is. There is no way to treat this disorder. And we just kind of threw that out the window. And, you know, I was very fortunate to have some visionaries at my side at that time. And one was Dr. Weber and another fellow Angelman parent and brilliant scientist, Dr. Rebecca Burdine. Mm-hmm. And we sat down and, like you said, we put together this roadmap and we looked at Angelman syndrome and going back to the uniqueness of the disorder and the imprinted gene there, we realized we had multiple paths that we could pursue. Now, this is going back to 2008, 2009. So the strategies and the tools that are available to us today were, you know, fantasy at that point. But we knew that, okay, how we had this disorder, how could we think about treating it? And the answer was, well, we could either turn on that silent copy of the paternal gene or replace the non-functional maternal copy. And with those two distinct strategies, we sat down and put together a roadmap of how we might be able to do that. And I think one of the most amazing things that both the foundation and Ed Weber were able to accomplish was that we put together this team of scientists that were willing to work collaboratively and mm-hmm. share data in real time. Because of the complicated subject that we were dealing with, we really needed expertise from many different disciplines. So to get those multiple disciplines together and have them be willing to share in real time data with each other, as you well know, Jimmy, that was a big ask mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. researchers typically, you know, work in their dark closets and they collect their data, they publish that, and that's their springboard to get additional funding and put a roof over their heads. We were asking this team of researchers that we assembled to not keep their knowledge or their data or their results close to their vest until they could publish it. We wanted it shared in real time amongst the team. And that's what we did. We created almost a virtual center of excellence. The researchers stayed at their own institutions mm-hmm. and we met weekly and discussed in real time. And then we met in person annually. And that really, really, really accelerated the research in ways that I don't think we could ever properly quantify. So you had experts in the genetics of it. You had experts in the, you know, learning and memory. You had experts in animal models. You had experts in epilepsy. You had experts in delivery systems. So it was getting all of that expertise together to work collaboratively. And then the other thing that we had to convince them to do was to do the type of work that may never lead to additional funding because there may never have been publishable results from that work. So we really asked them to just hold our hand and jump off a cliff, to trust us and trust that we would commit funding to them for the life of the project, the mm-hmm. initiative, and that it didn't matter if they pursued something that was a dead end, that we would provide them with funding, ongoing funding, to achieve all the aims that we had listed in this remarkable initiative. It's the work that was done at that time, you know, that's really yielding fruits today, you know. So you talk about the speed of science, you know, it was really that vision and that team that put the pieces in place that are leading to multiple different therapeutic avenues today in 2021. So yeah, we went out there, we kind of changed the dogma around mm-hmm. Angelman syndrome, and then we put this phenomenal team of experts and somehow convince them to work collaboratively and take all kinds of chances on technologies and strategies that were really at that time, you know, pie in the sky. You know, we find ourselves today in a position where, you know, all of these single gene disorders and these types of diseases are what I think we've collectively come to the agreement that they're treatable, sure. Right? But at the time that we were putting all of this together, there, you know, none of these tools were, you know,
absolutely.
Available
absolutely.
The way they are today. So it was very forward thinking, and we did a lot of work that was kind of definitely ahead of our time. But, you know, it was really Ed Weber and Becky Burdine that knew that you need to fund today what's going to be possible in 5 years and 10 years from now. You don't fund what's available today. You know, you always have to be funding into the future. And that's what happened with FAST. The type of work we funded and being able to fund projects like from A to Z, not just be giving seed money for them to publish and then go and try and find funding elsewhere, but really committing the funding necessary to complete a project from hypothesis to data, you know, that really just enabled us to be prepared for when the technologies were ready for prime time. So I think that's what I'm probably most proud of with FAST, just being able to, you know, kind of foresee the future and prepare for it.
Absolutely.
Well in advance.
This is the kind of forward thinking and thinking outside the box approach and taking big risk, big reward type of strategy to get where we are today. I would say it was a battle of between people believing in the impossible and people believing in what's possible, right? So, and that having this FAST family, and I know that firsthand, is made of people who do believe that everything is possible if you put your mind and heart into it. And that's my personal experience with FAST. And you know what? It draws like-minded people to the arena and allows for work that you would never have seen anywhere else to actually be done and proven, not necessarily proven to be working, maybe even proven to be not working, that allows to shift resources and shift hypotheses towards new venues and other venues.
I should definitely back up a minute there and just say that we definitely would not have gotten to where we are today without the support of the community. If it wasn't for our community, we certainly wouldn't be here, because they really did the heavy lifting of raising the money to fund the incredible work that was done. So it was really a combined effort between the patient organization, the community, and the team of scientists. Just really proud to be a part of each of those factions.
Kudos to the community that believed in the teamwork, right, between the scientists and the communities and the parents and the kids and the Angelman syndrome kids to move things forward in ways that were not done before. In that respect, Paula, can you tell us a little bit about most of the challenges to draw the community to understand what is happening and how you would go around that? What did you do to spread this awareness and this educational aspect, the relationship between the scientific community and the medical community and the Angelman syndrome community, the parents, the kids and caregivers on the other side?
That's a really excellent point, Jimmy. And I think that is a big roadblock in some of these rare diseases, because there was such a mantra that this was an untreatable, incurable condition. You know, when we started the FAST organization and I went out there and said, you know, we were going to cure Angelman syndrome, there was a lot of, how do I say this politely, you know, ridicule. And that was, you know, across the board, but certainly the community, because this was just such a radically different message than what had been beaten into them for so many years. So bringing the community on board was honestly the most important mm-hmm. piece of it. You know, we were very fortunate to find scientists that were willing to take some chances and think outside the box, but we would have never gotten anywhere if we didn't have the funding to provide to those scientists. So, and it was the community that was to credit for all of the funding that got mm-hmm. us here. So how do you bring your community along? I will tell you without hesitation, the only way you can do that is with complete transparency and spending the time to educate the community. This is difficult mm-hmm. subject matter. And I think I was fortunate to not have any background in genetics or biology or science. So I was able to see this through the same lens as most of the parents in my community. And, you know, what we needed to do was get our scientists in front of these parents and explain to them in a way that they could understand, but also on a level that was, you know, respectful. And our scientists managed to do that beautifully and effectively. Our scientists always took the time to, if a parent still didn't understand, they were available via email, and we had a yearly event that our scientists came to and spoke directly to our community of caregivers, of parents. And our scientists, you know, mingled all weekends and answered one-off questions. But really, it was just complete transparency. And then being willing to go over and over and over it, because it is difficult subject matter. So what does it mean to turn on a gene? What does it mean to replace a gene? What's a viral vector? Really doing the best job we could of educating the community and being very respectful of the fact that they were the ones that were paying for the work, and they deserve to know exactly what that work was, and they deserve to have, you know, the foundation and the scientists speak directly to them to explain that work and re-explain it and re-explain it and re-explain it if that's what was necessary. And basically that was the secret sauce, was just full transparency and education.
Wonderful, wonderful. I really wanted to touch on this point because I really would like to see the fast, successful experience be replicated across multiple other foundations in the rare neurological disease area. And so, because in our Neurology and Regenerative Medicine Center of Excellence at BioRSU, we run a lot of trials in the rare disease field, and especially in neurological rare diseases, one of the, I would say, rate-limiting factors or rate-limiting steps in having a successful clinical trial is having the buy-in from the community, right? Because at the end of the day, those parents and those kids will be involved in the clinical trial, and it will affect their lives. They don't know what they're going into. We invest a lot in the educational aspect to make sure that, you know, everyone understands what they're getting into and what is behind the therapeutic that is being at play there. It actually helps a lot. We see a lot of lack of awareness of what, you know, the disease is about. So there's not a lot of knowledge, you know, from the parents. But that's not what we see in the Angelman syndrome field, because, again, of the heroic efforts of the FAST Foundation to make sure that the parents and the caregivers understand what the disorder is about and what the therapeutic approach also is about. So that's also the other piece. I mean, not only understanding the disorder, but also understanding what is the approach that is being at play here to potentially cure or decrease the symptoms or enhance the quality of life of the patients who are living with that syndrome. At the end of the day, as you said, Paula, you're funding forward-thinking trials. And so if they don't understand the ins and outs, you can't have the buy-in.
I will mention, Jimmy, that it was definitely a process, right? So when we started on this journey, it was very much our scientists explaining, like you said, to our patient community, what causes Angelman and what an imprinted gene means and what a gene does. And, you know, it was really Angelman syndrome 101. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we gradually went from there to explaining the different research avenues and what we hope to glean from those studies and projects and initiatives. And then, you know, a few years ago, we didn't even have the scientists presenting to our community anymore. Mm-hmm. We then had so many pharmaceutical companies interested in developing therapeutics for Angelman that it was then the pharmaceutical companies speaking directly to the community. But by the time that happened, the organization and the scientists had already spent, you know, several years educating the community. So by the time the pharmaceutical companies were ready to engage, they had a well-informed, well-educated patient population that they were dealing with. It was definitely a process. It didn't happen overnight. You know, I remember the very first, the organization held an annual fundraiser every year in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And after the second or third year of it just being a fundraiser, we had Ed Weber hold like a science conference with the parents And it was funny, I remember that first one, and we did it like in the back room of like a hula hands, you know, we moved the parents in shifts, you know. Those were in the early days, and it grew to, you know, the Fast Science Conference, you know, the last in-person one we had about 1,500 parents in attendance. So much larger than what the local hula hands would be able to accommodate. But, you know, we started small. I don't want anybody listening, especially somebody who's getting a nonprofit, a patient org up and running, to think, you know, you snap your fingers and this happens. It was definitely a process. But we started back when, you know, these things were really just, like I said, pie in the sky dreams.
Yeah.
Now I think anybody that's in the rare disease space understands the different strategies available to us to manipulate genes. I don't think rare diseases are starting at quite the same stage zero that we were at. Mm-hmm. Like you said, things are moving so quickly now that you would probably benefit from a crash course if you were trying to teach a patient population, but ours was a bit more of a slow roll over, you know, probably a 10-year period from these concepts, from teaching the patients what actually causes Angelman to the concepts of what we were funding to potentially treat it, to the pharmaceutical companies coming to engage directly with the potential patients on what their particular, you know, strategy would entail. So it happened quickly. I think you and I could probably say it happened so quickly, you know, in the grand scheme of things. I think parents think it's take a bit more, you know, a bit more time, but I don't want anybody else that's out there that's just entering a rare disease diagnosis and thinking of starting a patient organization to think it happens with the snap of a finger. It can happen quicker than it did for FAST, only because we're in a different time right now, but educating the community is critical, absolutely critical. And, you know, that's an ongoing process. I mean, not just from having a yearly, you know, science conference, but constantly communicating with your community. Mm-hmm. And in the day and age that we live in, where there's all kinds of social media, there's no excuse why you can't do that.
True.
So videos and articles and, you know, just that constant communication, especially when it's difficult subject matter, like most of these, you know, rare diseases are.
That's a great point, Paula. And yes, I agree with you. Maybe the definition of fast from discovery to clinic, it would be different than what a parent, you know, other parents would think about. I mean, for them, maybe it's too slow. They want it tomorrow, right? But in the grand scheme of things, I can say from my own experience and being, you know, working on the clinical development side, this is definitely one of the fastest turnarounds that I've ever seen in the industry. And, you know, kudos to you and the foundation for making this type of work, of high quality work, actually, you know, to happen and to materialize. That would be actually a segue for me for my next question to you, Paula, is today with all of these new clinical trials that are, you know, either ongoing or going to start up in the near future, what would you say it would be the challenges for Angelman syndrome kids or their parents, you know, to accept to participate in those clinical trials? What would you say would be the most rate-limiting step or the rate-limiting challenges in that area?
I think two things. I think this is a community that is very interested and anxious for therapeutics. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think that works in our favor, especially through the lens of the pharmaceutical companies, right? No one wants to invest in a patient population that isn't themselves invested in developing therapeutics for their child's disorder. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But, you know, every clinical trial is going to be different. And I would be the last person to advise a parent as to what to do. I mean, that's always such a personal decision that should be discussed, you know, with their medical team. But again, it goes back to, you know, educating the parent. I think delivery systems, when it comes to the manipulation of genes, whether you're turning genes on or, you know, inserting genes, I think all day long, it comes down to the delivery system and, you know, what are the challenges there? And then, of course, you know, any experimental medication is, it's exhilarating and terrifying at the same time, right?
Yeah, it holds its own risks.
You're entering the unknown.
True.
You know, it's funny, FAST actually had funded its own clinical trial on minocycline back in 2012.
I remember that very well.
We had run some FDA-approved drugs through mm-hmm. our animal model, and minocycline showed some benefit. Mm-hmm. And we actually won a contest. The NPO won a contest that the community won for us, mm-hmm. and we won $250,000, which was honestly, like, at that point in time, an insane amount of money us.
Yeah.
Okay. And we used it to fund a small clinical trial to see if minocycline would be beneficial to patients with Angelman syndrome. And this was minocycline that has a 40-plus year history of safety and known side effects. And that was very frightening for parents to sign up for that. So it's not easy. It's not an easy decision to sign up for a clinical trial. And each one is very different. And you could have multiple companies within the same disease space developing, you know, similar technologies, right? But every drug is going to be different. So it's such a personal decision, you know, all day long. All you can do as a patient org, you know, educate your community. All you can do as a pharmaceutical company is to educate your community so that they can make the best decisions they can make. You know, that's all you can do there. And from a pharmaceuticals company's point of view, you know, evaluating whether it's a patient population that wants therapeutics. And because FAST was able to hold this yearly event and the pharmaceutical companies were invited, I think they were always taken aback by how many parents were there in one place at one time. It's very difficult, right? When you have a child that has a disorder like Angelman syndrome, and I speak from my personal experience, it's very hard to find caretakers. Yeah. Our children are very complicated, and you can't leave them, you know, with the teenage babysitter down the block. So finding qualified, you know, child care is one of the largest challenges my fellow Angelman parents face. And to be able to get 1,200, 1,500 parents from around the world in one room at one time was amazing to the pharmaceutical companies. And it sent a very clear message that this was a patient population that was very anxious for treatments. So, and they were there to learn and get as much information as they could to go back to their own medical team, discuss what was emerging. And then when clinical trials actually opened up, that they were as educated as they could be in order to make the decision on whether to enroll their child or not. And really, that's what it comes down to. All you can do is be transparent, educate potential patient, you know, population, pool of patients, and just be honest and straightforward, and always encourage them to make those decisions in consultation with the team who knows their child best. And if you have a population like the Angelman syndrome community, you know, in rare disease, right? The initial trials, you don't need 5,000 patients. That's not how rare disease works. So in a community like Angelman syndrome, you're probably going to have the opposite, where you have many more people that want to enroll in a clinical trial on a potential novel therapeutic than being, you know, hesitant to do so.
Yeah, and if you allow me, I want to add one more point to that. I mean, this is very enlightening, I would say, for the people who hear us. And I want to emphasize on how important for, you know, this participation to happen in rare clinical disease trials. It's a process, and it all takes time. All of this takes time and effort and tedious attention to details and small changes along the way, right? And these would be the stepping stones to reach where we are today.
Yes, this is true. And you know, this goes back to the importance of the community. And when I was the chair of FAST, it was so paramount to me that the community knew that they were the most, every piece of it is important when you're trying to identify and develop therapeutics, but you're never going to be anywhere without your community. From my perspective, they raised all the money for the research. But in addition, like you had mentioned, you know, assessments. You know, we had reached a certain point in Angelman where I fully realized that our science was in great shape. You know, the future was looking brighter and brighter. And, you know, the realization that, you know, it's time now to focus on the clinic and how are we going to measure changes in, in these patients. That was a huge concern because the, as you know, right, there's standard tests that are used. And, you know, if you have a patient that's, you know, three deviations below floor, you know, even if they went up three deviations, which would be amazing in the time period of a clinical trial, they're still going to be at zero. So how do you properly assess these, you know, potentials in the clinic? So it was amazing at that time how the community, and I mean the community of, you know, of KOLs, the patient organizations, the scientists, the clinicians, you know, the pharma companies, to also work collaboratively and pre-competitively to say, which tools are we going to use? But more importantly, what tools do we have to create so we could properly assess changes in our children once we're in, you know, clinical trial? And that was an amazing initiative in and of itself. And FAST was able to fund, you know, a couple of novel outcome assessments. And, you know, again, that was like the community rallied. We needed to do a disease concept model. And every time that we have to do something like this, where we need the community just to participate in surveys and questionnaires and those kind of things, we always, it's, we don't struggle to get that participation. We usually have more participation than we actually need. And it's just a testament to this, just this amazing community of my fellow parents that are just so dedicated to their children. They're dedicated to the science. They're dedicated to the pharma companies. It's, you know, it's just this wonderful circular relationship with all the players that are in the room at the table, everybody working together, doing their part, whatever part that is, however big or however small, but everyone contributing to where we are, which is on the cusp of potentially transformative treatments for this patient population.
Any last words you want to give, Paula, to organizations maybe who are similar to FAST or nascent organizations or people who might be thinking of, maybe I should be doing that for my child or for the rare disease that, you know, that is afflicting a person or a family member, you know, that is close to them? What would you tell them today?
I would say that the rare disease patient organizations are probably the most powerful players in drug development right now. They are really the ones pushing the boulders up the hill. And the power that you have to change lives is immeasurable. And when your inspiration is your child, there's just nothing bigger or greater than that, right? Wanting to improve the life of your loved one is a motivation that no one else possesses, right? Except you. And the power that you have to make change. I remember when I started and the thought of changing the landscape of Angelman syndrome was overwhelming. You do it by like one foot in front of the other, and you really do have a lot of power here. I think the patient orgs in this age are the most powerful players. And when you're committed and just identify a really good team, if you have a mission, you're being inspired by somebody that you love, this is the time. We're in an amazing time. We're seeing medical miracles everywhere we look. I mean, you look at just the COVID vaccine and what we were able to do when we pooled our resources and realized the importance of what needed to be done and supported those who knew how to do the work. We saw the impossible realized in record time. And, you know, miracles happen and medical miracles. We are now living in a time where we see them all around us. You know, we are curing cancers. We are curing blindness. We are curing horrific pediatric disorders like spinal muscular atrophy. It's not pie in the sky anymore. Yeah, there's ups and downs. But when you're driven by the love of your child, the love you have for your child, it's all good in the end. It's a labor of love, but it's probably the most gratifying work I've ever done in my life.
Thank you so much, Paula, for your participation today and for for your thoughts and for your ideas and for your inspiration. And I hope that we've helped a lot of our audience today with the information that you brought in. I look forward to working with you even more within FAST. I'm really honored to be part of the family. And I think that FAST does what nobody does today.
If you enjoyed this podcast or have suggestions for future episodes and how we can make it better, please get in touch with us. You can email us at fewandfarbetween@biorassi.com or contact us at our website at biorassi.com.